From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to June 15, 1961. The first secretary of the Socialist Unity Party, Walter Ulbricht, was giving an international news conference, and he denied having any intention of building a Berlin Wall. But it also marked the first time that the term Mauer, or wall, was used in this way in this public a setting. And of course, we know what followed. 6 weeks later, the transcript of a phone call between Ulbricht and Nikita Khrushchev indicate that it might have been Khrushchev who was pushing most hardest. That contrasts with some of the other sources who said Khrushchev was worried about what the West might think. Well, regardless, Saturday, August 12th, 1961, that plan was in motion. At a garden party in a government guest house, Ulbricht signed the order to close the border and erect a wall. By midnight, the army and the police began to shut down the border. By Sunday morning, August 13th, East German troops had already begun to tear up the streets to make it impassable for vehicles. Barbed wire went up, and the first concrete blocks were in place 4 days later. And so it was until 1989, 25 years ago this week, when the wall finally fell. This hour, we examine the rise and the fall of the wall, looking at who traditionally gets the credit, but who really deserves it. One of our guests not only has taught on the subject of Russian history and Eastern European studies, but has been there on a number of occasions, starting in, Randy Stone, 1986?
That's right.
1986. Randy Stone is a professor of political science and the director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Also in studio is Chad Post, the publisher of Open Letter Books. And Chad, you've brought The Wall in My Head, which is a book that was issued on the 20th anniversary. Book is available now. And what is The Wall in My Head?
The Wall in My Head is a collection of essays and poems and journalistic pieces from writers throughout the Eastern Europe area about the wall in relation to the wall, both pre-fall and post. And it's also, as you can, I give you a copy so you can see this for anyone who can't see it. It is loaded with photographs, archive materials. It's a brilliant book that gives you a perspective from all these different angles as to the how the wall functioned in people's heads, in society, in writing, in culture.
Where can people get it?
They can get it online at our website, which is openletterbooks.org, but also from any of the local bookstores, which basically means mostly Barnes & Noble, and any online retailer.
All right, we're going to be talking more about some of the interesting things that are in The Wall in My Head. Let me make sure I get the history right, though. Randy Stone, Nikita Khrushchev, was he worried about what the West would think?
Well, he was concerned. There's an interesting, fairly recent book on this by one of my former office mates at Harvard, Hope Harrison. It's called Driving the Soviets Up the Wall. She did an extensive archival work and makes, I think, a very compelling argument that the Soviets actually were pulling back all this time, were resistant to the idea, and that it was the East German leadership that was most concerned about the Germans who were fleeing communist Germany, undermining the economic performance of the country, but also fundamentally undermining the sense that there was a legitimate communist alternative to the democratic West.
So Walter Ulbricht gets most of the credit for you.
Yeah, it's so far as there's credit to divide up. I think he was the one who took the crucial step, who actually stole a march on Khrushchev. It was a surprise. Khrushchev wasn't quite prepared for it when it happened. And then Khrushchev very quickly realized, well, we can't let this collapse. We have to be all in here. And he was concerned that there might be a military confrontation with the West over this. But Ulbricht, over the years, kept pushing Khrushchev to be more assertive vis-a-vis the United States than he was comfortable being. And we have a memory of Khrushchev as being the guy who banged the shoe on the table and was a little unpredictable and kept creating crises. But Ulbricht could never have enough. He always wanted to push him further, push him harder. He was really a hard line of Stalinist. Khrushchev's instincts were to be a little bit more middle of the road.
And what about Kennedy's posture? How did it impact the decision-making process there? Was it accurate to say that Kennedy had sort of given overtures that the West, or at least the United States, would not essentially intervene in the creation of a wall? Or how did that play?
I don't think that the Kennedy administration had any significant impact on this at all. This was a decision really between the East German leadership and the Soviets. And they had been talking about it since at least 1953. There was a very substantial uprising on June 17th, 1953, when the Soviets were, the East German communists were kicked out of Berlin. There were uprisings in most of the major cities and many towns in East Germany. It was a full-fledged revolution, and it was put down only with Soviet tanks. So there was a sense right from the beginning of the Cold War, or shortly after Stalin's death in March of 53, that the East German regime was very shaky and could collapse at any moment. And so the East Germans were always pushing, this is a sore spot. We've got to do something about this. This is a constant drain of highly educated people leaving our country. This undermines everything we're trying to claim in our propaganda and so forth. And so when they threw it up, they actually called the wall an anti-fascist defense barrier. Right, this was their justification. So they're defending themselves against those dangerous people in West Berlin.
The anti-fascist defense barrier.
That's right.
That's brilliant.
That's clever.
Did anybody buy it?
No, of course not.
No, of course. But before we get to, again, we're looking at 25 years this week since the fall of the wall. Before we even get to 1989, take us through, Randy, just briefly, sort of the psychology of what happened in those weeks that followed the beginning of the construction of the wall in August. What was the immediate impact?
Well, there was a huge immediate impact on many thousands of people who lived in East Berlin and perhaps worked in West Berlin, or reverse. There were families who were divided by the wall. There were thousands of poignant stories about people who were caught on the wrong side, and people who made choices that turned out to be fateful. And then never got a chance to see their loved ones again. If you ever get a chance to go to Berlin and visit it, there's a very poignant museum right where Checkpoint Charlie used to be, about all of the attempts to cross the wall, most of which ended in terrible tragedy, but some of which were successful. There was the famous case of the woman who put her baby in luggage and smuggled her across the border. But there were also many people who died trying to cross the wall.
I remember reading my father's journal when he went to Europe in 1966 as a man in his 20s, and just his impressions of seeing Checkpoint Charlie and seeing just feeling that division. And he even wrote in his journal then that he couldn't believe the world could feel so divided. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it seemed to have been sort of at least at that moment, a success, I guess. But here we are now, 25 years, and I read a very interesting commentary from Jay Rosen, who is a media critic for New York University. And he was critiquing a piece in the New York Times by Mary Elise Sirote called How the Fall of the Berlin Wall Really Happened. Now, she writes, quote, "The opening of the Berlin Wall 25 years ago this Sunday marked a surprisingly joyous end to a conflict that could have erupted into thermonuclear combat. In the decades since, many Americans have come to believe that the wall fell thanks to President Ronald Reagan's direct personal intervention. In that 1987 speech in front of the Brandenburg Gate in a divided Berlin, he told Soviet leaders to, quote, tear down this wall, and so, we've been told, they did. This misreading of the actual fall of the wall is, at best, incomplete. At worst, it's dangerous, contributing to the belief that American leaders can go from, quote, Berlin to Baghdad, shaping world events while ignoring the complex realities of the goals." Jay Rosen said, we all know this by now, that we don't need this kind of piece because nobody really thinks Ronald Reagan did that anymore. I don't agree. I think that, and I don't know what you think, Randy, but I think there is still a large public perception that President Reagan had some sort of direct impact with that speech.
Well, there are slightly more sophisticated versions of the argument that Ronald Reagan should get the credit for the end of the Cold War. He does get widely credited with that, I think, by at least the right half of the political spectrum in this country. And I think many public intellectuals argue that way. In England, of course, Margaret Thatcher gets a lot of credit as well. They did take very principled positions against communism. You can't ever take that away from them. That was a position that they took, and they defended it very, very consistently. And in fact, Ronald Reagan is to this day a very popular American president in Russia. Deservedly or not, he has that very strong reputation in Russia. But the argument that is usually made is that it was something about our military posture or our military buildup under Reagan, which somehow squeezed the Soviet economy, caused it eventually to overheat and collapse. And it was the collapse of the economy which then led Gorbachev to release the Soviet satellites. And that's really incorrect in every particular. It is true that the United States had a significant military buildup, including the Star Wars program and so forth. And the Soviets were very concerned about the Star Wars program, not because they thought it would work, but because they couldn't imagine that we would be wasting so much money on something that wouldn't work. We must know something that they didn't, right? so they really were concerned about
fear of the unknown. How interesting.
Yes. But Soviet military spending did not respond to U.S. military spending. They had a five-year plan. They had their plan for what they were going to spend on the military set before Ronald Reagan came into office. And until 1985, the time when Mikhail Gorbachev came into office, there was no opportunity to adjust it. And he started cutting the military as soon as he arrived. So it's not true that anything that we did exacerbated their economic difficulties. It's also not true, I think, that the economic difficulties forced their hand here. They made certain choices. Gorbachev very clearly signaled that he was not going to rescue the East European satellites. If they were not legitimate on their own, he was not going to invade them as the Soviet Union had done in Germany in 1953, in Hungary in 1956, in Czechoslovakia in 1968, and threatened to do in Poland in 1981. That was forestalled by the imposition of martial law in Poland. He made it clear that he wasn't going to do that. And that undermined the sort of social contract in those countries, where the people promised not to rise up and the communists would promise to keep the Soviets out of the country.
Okay. So a little more complex than just one man and one president. But mm-hmm. Does it bother you as an educator, does it bother you that we even need op-eds like this? And look, it's always important to look at the complexities of what happened. But does it bother you that 25 years later, there's still a large public perception in this country about how it happened and it seems so far off base?
Well, it's something that you struggle with as an educator because your students come in with their preconceptions and then you talk about them. But it does give you something to discuss in class. And it's a really easy subject for a
sure.
debate. I like to set up debates between my students, and this is one that is always a nice, juicy one.
Is there a concern that this comes in with a little bit of a political charge in that if you undermine the narrative, mm-hmm. that you're somehow anti-conservative, anti-Reagan, et cetera?
Well, certainly people do tend to line up along those lines. I think a stronger case could be made that the Reagan policies actually delayed the end of the Cold War, that Gorbachev was trying to reach accommodations, and he was looking for a big breakthrough on foreign policy, big arms control deals and so forth, which would reinforce his narrative internally in the country, which is that we don't have to spend so much money on the military, that we can reorient our priorities, we can get ourselves out of this unsustainable hole that we've built. And there was tremendous resistance from his conservative flank, the military, the people who ended up carrying out the coup against him in 1991. The police, the KGB, and the military, and he managed to change the leadership of all those institutions over time. We thought that he was in control of them, but evidently he never really was. And he needed foreign policy successes in order to keep himself afloat while he was doing a number of dangerous things, opening up, liberalizing the politics, losing control of the party, liberalizing the economy, and so forth. He was doing a lot of very dangerous, high-wires type things. And it could have turned the other way. We could have lost the opportunity to end the Cold War because the coup happened a few years earlier. And I was struck in 1989 as we saw these images of people streaming across the Hungarian-Austrian border and the Berlin Wall falling down and the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia and so forth, and Solidarity coming to power in Poland. One of my professors turned to me at one point as we were walking across campus and said, you know, Stalin wouldn't have any trouble dealing with all of this. He would have known how to solve the problem.
What a terrible but probably chillingly accurate thought. Randy Stone is in studio. He's a professor of political science and the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Chad Post is a publisher of Open Letter Books, and we've been talking about some of the machinations that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall, but we're also going to be talking about some of the personal stories. And in a moment, I'm going to ask Randy to share some of his own experience beginning in 1986. But Chad, as I look at the book, The Wall in My Head, there's, for me, I'm not a big fan of having people in the studio with a book unless I've read it, but here I am having not read this book. And so let me also say that just going through it, there's a lot of very interesting personal stories that I want to dive into immediately. Tell me about some of the way the book is composed.
The book came about as an interesting story in itself, is that this came about through Words Without Borders, which is an online magazine and nonprofit organization designed to promote international literature and understanding of other cultures. And every month they have a magazine that publishes X number of pieces from around the world from a particular theme. And every so often they kind of call these together and create an anthology. So back 5-6 years ago, they contacted Open Letter and wanted to do this anthology with us. So the two editors that need to be really acknowledged here are Rohan Camichero, as I'm going to mispronounce that, and Sal Robinson, were the two people that worked at Words Without Borders to help kind of construct all of these pieces, some of which had appeared in English, a lot that hadn't, that they had to get translated and work on and put together. But the overarching guiding theme was that to understand really the impact of the wall, there's one thing of like looking at the politics and the explanations that we have from our perspective here in the U.S., in which up until now, I really thought David Hasselhoff was really responsible for the fall of the Berlin Wall. Like, and thank you for correcting me on that as a learning experience. But no, but in addition to that, to get to see the people who were actually living with this as a daily experience, that were cut off from their families, that did live under the shadow of the wall. So a lot of the pieces are very personal. There are stories of, some of them are very fictional. Like there's one, Paris Lost, in which it's a fictional recounting of someone going on a vacation in Russia to like an imaginary Paris where they're like, oh, you're going to Paris, you know, it's time to go abroad. And there's like a fake Eiffel Tower and it's all like kind of a ruse to make it seem like everything's perfect and fine living in Russia at this point in time. Other ones are more political. There's one about the Velvet Revolution and this relation to the plastic people and to music. And then there's a series of things from the post wall falling period in which we have younger writers, especially from Romania and some of the more satellite countries, writing about what life is like now that this particular system and this particular worldview have dissolved, and that things are different now, and they're different in a way that's also very interesting. But the point of the book really was to try and provide American readers with an additional perspectives, that it's not just like our historians explaining the story, but also the people that are living in Czechoslovakia at the time, in Latvia and Lithuania, talking about what was happening in their own personal lives and in their own situation.
And still, in many cases, some moving stories of occasionally great danger. I mean, again, I go back to some of the weeks and months leading up to November 9th, 1989. And for those of us, again, who've gone through history thinking that this was planned very carefully, et cetera, there's a killing by a guard, wasn't it, in February of the same year. And there was still a lot of tension. And then Randy Stone, it was perhaps a bit of a bungling by Gunter Schabowski and the Politburo sort of bungling this announcement that things would be, there would be a again, that ease of restriction on travel that what I've read is, oops, that people start taking this as the wall is open on November 9th. And it looks like to me just a botched operation as opposed to a very carefully, slowly planned out opening.
Oh, absolutely. And the East German regime did not want this to happen.
Right.
They got their signals crossed. They made an announcement, which was interpreted this way. It was kind of an ambiguous statement. Was interpreted that, now we can go. And people rushed to the wall because they had been wanting to do this for so many years.
The announcement was supposed to say what?
I don't recall the details.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
From what I've read, I think it was a sort of like just an easing or kind of a not a huge change in policy, but it was interpreted that way because of a bungling by the Politburo. And then all of a sudden, people are rushing to the wall, and it's like things have changed.
Right. No, that's exactly the way I remember it. But there was something about the statement that was ambiguous, and
how could they do that? I mean, isn't that amazing?
Got to stay on message. No, the East German regime was one of the most extreme, least inclined to reform in the communist bloc. And part of the reason for that was they understood that there was no margin for them. They had no legitimacy in this population. And so if they did not hold on with an iron fist, they would not hold on. The Polish Communist Party was considerably more open, and people in Poland for decades had much more freedom than in East Germany. And you also see that in the internal diplomacy among the countries. I did my first book on Soviet East European trade relations. And one thing that came through there was that many of the other countries were much more comfortable with Gorbachev's proposals for economic reform. And the East Germans were kicking and screaming all the way, opposing everything in private. Of course, in public, it was unity. But they did not want this to happen. It was an accident. The people rushed to the wall and then saw their opportunity. But the guards didn't know what to do.
Couldn't there have been a violent suppression at that moment?
That's what everyone expected would happen under those circumstances. Everybody expected that if there was an attempt by the population to take over the wall, the guards would do what they were ordered to do. They would shoot, and there would be a bloodbath. And it didn't happen. Partly, I think what you see is that at these key moments in history, everything depends upon the power of the idea. And there was no legitimacy for this regime. Even the guards didn't believe in the regime either, and they didn't want to shoot. So I think that was what was critical. They did. There were messages back to police headquarters. What are we supposed to do? They're coming. Are we supposed to shoot? And they did not get an immediate response. So perhaps had there been an immediate response and a coordinated reaction, they might have stopped the wall from falling. But there was no coordination. People were paralyzed. In part, I think that was because everyone within the Communist Party hierarchy was counting the days. They were already thinking that the regime's days were probably numbered because Gorbachev had given that secret message to Erich Honecker, who was by this time the leader of the GDR, as it was called, the East German regime, that we're not going to support you. And if they tried to hold back this flood of humanity, they would fail without Soviet support, and then they would be war criminals.
Amazing stuff. Before we let Chad Post go, again, publisher of Open Letter Books, the book is called The Wall in My Head. It was released at the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall, but available now. Words and Images from the Fall of the Iron Curtain. And for me, Chad, and for anybody who grew up with that simple narrative, seeing that soundbite of tear down this wall, and for me, this adds such human texture to a much more complicated story.
It really absolutely does. And there's the images are amazing for this, like how that all got pulled together and is placed in there. There is a whole section that's just pictures that sort of like marks the point between the pre and the post writers. But it is, it's incredible. It's an incredible book that we put together here. And it's just as relevant now as it was on the 20th anniversary, obviously. The voices are still the same. One of my favorite pieces in it, if you're going to read one, is The Souvenirs of Communism by Dubravka Jugrasek, who's one of my favorite authors of all time. And it opens with her basically in Russia, in Moscow, a few years after the wall came down, waiting in line still, as that was a major thing in Russia throughout their time. And this guy comes up and starts to like hit on her essentially. And he's like, you know, why don't you get out of line for coffee and I'll go buy you a drink and whatever. And he's like, well, who are you? And she's like, oh, I'm a writer. And he's like, well, you look at that. I've run into so many babes in my life, whores and drunks, but never a woman writer. And she's like, who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm a lush. And then he goes on to tell her that he had sworn that he would drink and would live until he's seen communism dead. And he's like, only then will I be able to go peacefully in my grave. And she's like, well, it's dead now, right? He's like, I'll be sticking around for another couple of years just to make sure. Just a kind of an amazing like moment in time there. But her voice is amazing. And a lot of the pieces in here are like stunningly good and add so much.
Randy, was there uncertainty even after this happened? Because in the final weeks of the year of 1989, it seemed like, as we see in The Wall in My Head, the world starts coming and, you know, everybody wants to see it, et cetera. But was there doubt about the lasting impact or concern at that time?
There was tremendous uncertainty and just a sense of disbelief. I mean, all those of us who had been studying communist politics were convinced that this wasn't going to happen. And we had to feel it. We had to see it for ourselves. So as soon as I could, you know, I was in graduate school at the time, I rushed over to Germany and went to see the wall and had to get a tactile sense. You know, I picked up a sledgehammer and smashed some pieces off of the remnants of the wall to show, to convince myself that no, it's you can really do that. Probably the most stunning thing for me was walking through where the Brandenburg Gate.
Well, here let's take our break. Let's let Chad run off. We'll come back in about 60 seconds, get to more. We'll get to some of your phone calls. And if you want to join the program, I see the phone's ringing. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Professor Randy Stone's going to tell us about what those personal experiences were like as we mark 25 years this week from the fall of the Berlin Wall. Short break, and you next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're talking diabetes, the latest in diagnosis and treatment. Then we're talking TEDx. You're probably familiar with TED Talks. Well, TEDx are the local versions, and there is a big event coming to Rochester soon. We meet some of the people who will be speaking at TEDx 2014 in Rochester, get some of their ideas on issues affecting our community. All of that Wednesday on Connections.
The Common Core standards require kids to read complex works. In Reno, a fifth grade teacher worried a tough poem would stump her students. Then she tried it.
Even my historically low achieving students said to the class, it's a pattern. And they all went, oh!
Reading Common Core, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And before we get to some of your phone calls, let me ask Professor Stone to take us through some of those personal moments. Your first visit to the Berlin Wall, 1986.
That's right. So I was a college student, exchange student in Germany that year. And so I got a chance to get to Berlin. And one of the images of the Berlin Wall that has always stuck with me was standing on the East Berlin side of the Brandenburg Gate, looking across to where the Reichstag stands, the German Parliament building. At that time, it was the historical German Parliament building, and now it's the Parliament where the United German Parliament meets. And having this visceral sense that if I were seized by vertigo or by some impulse to run towards the wall. You sometimes think of you're standing at the Grand Canyon or something. What happened if I slipped? I would be shot. Right? It was just clear that there were crow's nests with machine guns in them in my peripheral vision. And it took about 3 hours to get from one side to the other. right, from the Brandenburg Gates, from the Reichstag side of the Brandenburg Gate to the Pariser Platz side in East Berlin. And so there was a sense of tremendous distance. There was this huge natural chasm there, like the Grand Canyon, where you have to go a long way to get around from one side to the other. And then all of a sudden it was gone. So I went back in 1990 and walked through from the east to the west, all the time thinking about when I'd been there 4 years before and how it was impenetrable. And somehow it was almost like I was taking a warp step from one reality to the next, and I was able to cross this unbridgeable chasm. It was really quite surrealistic. And I kept looking over my shoulder just to make sure there was nobody in the crow's nest.
I just imagine people who live there. And again, when you're there, June 1990, a lot of the wall was still up. And the world must have felt that magnetism that you did, that you wanted to do it in a tactile sense, that you wanted to be sure that this was really happening. When did the wall actually kind of really come down? It was there for a while.
That's right. Well, there were big gaps in it when I got there in June, and one could move freely between, and there were no longer any police obstacles or anything. But in June 1990, there were still two countries. There was still the German Democratic Republic, or former communist East Germany, and there was the Bundesrepublik Deutschland, which the Federal Republic of West Germany. And so there were still two currencies at that point. There was a black market exchange rate, which was about 10 to 1 East German marks for West German marks. And there was a promise that they would be exchanged at 1 to 1 in the summer, but no one believed it. Right? So I was actually there doing some interviews, and I did interviews in former East German ministries, the Central Planning Commission and so forth, and talked to their officials who were still receiving a paycheck, and they were still there. But very soon they brought out the cognac, and they said, "Well, you know, we don't really have anything to do, so we might as well." Might as well have a drink with
have
you.
Have a nip of cognac, sure. And did you?
I did, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Let's get Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, you're on with Professor Randy Stone. Go ahead.
Thanks. I have a kind of a more general question. It seems to me, and by the way, I have a connection to this. My brother was a Russian translator, but he worked for the NSA, and he won't talk about what he did even to this date. But my question is, based on what we know, how does that affect or not affect our reaction? It seems to me that you've talked a lot about, if you will, unknown things and so on and so forth. So what we know, do we use it credibly in what we do? And where do we stand today, given what the world is up to? So I appreciate your comment on, do we have the knowledge and do we use it properly? Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bernard.
I guess this is a question about the intelligence services. What do they really know? What is the value? What is the value of secrecy? What's the value of the investment that we make in gathering intelligence? One really interesting anecdote about that regards an analysis that the CIA did of the U.S. embassy in Moscow. And it turned out that the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, right from the beginning, was riddled with bugs. And so lots of, that is not with insects, but with listening devices. And so right from they probably had cockroaches too, since it was Moscow. But right from the beginning, they were, many of the things that they were saying or doing or writing that they thought were secure were actually compromised and had been fed right to the KGB. And so they did an analysis in the 1960s when they figured this out and decided, well, we're going to have to tear down the whole structure and build a new embassy from scratch. Turned out that one had listening devices in it too, and they had to tear it down again. But what was the damage to U.S. national security from this unbelievable security breach, right? A real coup by the KGB? And they couldn't really find any damage that was done. They couldn't point to anything in particular that had actually been harmful. But there was one case in which it was perhaps quite significant, which is that when Eisenhower came into office, he came in 1953 with the promise that we're going to end the Korean War. We're going to do that by being much more aggressive than we've been in the past. We're not going to settle for stonewalling tactics in the negotiations. We're going to threaten to use nuclear weapons if necessary in order to end this conflict. There was a lot of bluff and bluster. But there was an agreement very shortly thereafter. And the CIA analysis suggested that this may have been in part due to the fact that there was a message sent to the Moscow embassy to burn all non-essential documents, which is the same message that is usually sent right before war breaks out. That was the same message that was intercepted in 1941 from the Japanese to the Japanese embassy in Washington, burn all non-essential documents just before Pearl Harbor. Right. And so this is interpreted by the CIA analysts as perhaps a credible signal to the Soviets, precisely because we did not know that they were monitoring our communications, right, that something was about to happen. And this may have contributed in a positive way to getting the Soviets to put pressure on the North Koreans to agree to our terms in 1953. Just the irony of that there was no clear damage done by a tremendous breach of secrecy, but perhaps a great tactical gain.
I hope that answers your question, Bernard. And in 1953, if there was a lot of bluff and bluster, as you say, mm-hmm. here is John writing into the program asking, aren't you missing the long game? Aren't you minimizing the impact that Reagan and Thatcher had? They really don't deserve any credit at all. Well, I don't know if Randy's saying no credit, but again, John is apparently saying that there was a long game in the Cold War and that Reagan and his ilk deserve more credit. What do you think?
Well, it certainly was a long game. I think in terms of the long-term strategy of the United States in the Cold War, there wasn't much distinction between Democratic and Republican presidents or Congress, for that matter. It was a period of remarkable bipartisanship, in part because the political spectrum was broadly united about what our strategy ought to be. We were committed to NATO. There wasn't much question about that. We're committed to a posture of nuclear deterrence that was somewhat controversial, but based on broad-based consensus and so forth. And our strategy in the Cold War was just to wait. I think George F. Kennan put it best, that we should, where necessary, confront the Soviet Union so that it does not expand the area of communist control, but then just wait for its internal contradictions to cause it to unravel. And that was essentially our strategy. We weren't as confident as he was that it would in fact unravel, but we thought that just waiting was the best strategy. In terms of the contributions of Reagan's strategy, I'm really quite skeptical. I think that his arms buildup, and particularly the investment in the Strategic Defense Initiative, or popularly Star Wars, made it more difficult for the Soviets to reduce their nuclear weapons and for Gorbachev to build a consensus around doing that. His tremendous skepticism towards all of the Soviet proposals in the 1980s slowed down the pace by which rapprochement could have taken place. Gorbachev kept surprising the Reagan administration and then the Bush administration with additional proposals for unilateral withdrawals and cutbacks and so forth and so on. I've just recently been reading James Baker's memoirs. He was the Secretary of State under the George H.W. Bush administration. It's striking how frustrated he was by the Soviet Union making all these proposals. They kept winning the game of public relations, and he found that very frustrating, and wished they would stop doing it. There was this sense that they were always sure that they were being schnookered, But in the end, as we saw, Gorbachev was in fact willing to pull all of his troops out of Eastern Europe. He was willing to dramatically disarm the Soviet Union. He really did want peace. And had we been prepared to cooperate a little sooner, he might have lasted longer.
Martin wants to know about Gorbachev. What is Gorbachev's reputation now within Germany and former Soviet states?
Now, it's very interesting. He is very popular in Germany. Of course, he, I think, is widely credited with allowing not only the fall of the Berlin Wall, but then German unification. Because he, of course, he agreed to permit it. And even after after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was by no means certain that he would permit it. He still had Soviet divisions stationed all over East Germany, and no one was going to fight the Soviet Union to force German unification. He could have simply said "Niet." He chose not to. He thought he extracted a promise from the United States that in return we would not expand NATO. And so many in the Soviet Union and in Russia feel that we went back on that promise. But his reputation in Russia is a completely different thing. Gorbachev is seen as a symbol of weak leadership, as someone who caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think he is really vilified. In contrast, Boris Yeltsin, who succeeded him as leader of Russia, is viewed much more favorably. Even he is viewed fairly unfavorably. And the most favorably viewed politician in Russia is, guess who? Vladimir Putin.
What does the evidence say about whether we did go back on our word regarding the expansion of NATO?
It's unclear exactly what was promised. It was not put into a treaty in those terms. There were certain commitments made later. There was a commitment made in 1997 that NATO would not station troops permanently in the new member states. But these early agreements didn't specify precisely what was required. So Gorbachev thought he had a gentleman's agreement, and it turns out that American presidents come and go. And I think George H.W. Bush was committed to not expanding NATO because he was in on the arrangement, and Bill Clinton was not consulted, did not consider himself bound.
Yeah, that wasn't his deal. That wasn't his agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't feel very interesting. Let's grab Patrick in Rochester. Patrick, you're on with Professor Andy Stone. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Full disclosure, it's Patrick Adams, and Randy and I have known each other for a number of years.
Hi, Patrick.
But hi, how you doing? I was real interested in the recent developments. I read about almost a nationalization of the educational books in Russia, the annexation of territories nearby, and the push toward almost an exclusive Russian culture, a promotion of Russian culture, to which I have firsthand experience with a 17-year-old Russian girl. My question is, you've been from St. Petersburg to Siberia. What is Russian? There's like 200 ethnic cultures.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, there's an important distinction in Russian between Ruski and Rossiyski. Whereas Ruski means Russian, as in the ethnicity, the language, the literature, and so forth. And Rossiyski refers to the Russian Federation and the territory that it embraces, which includes over 100 ethnic groups that all speak their own languages and who have a variety of interests and so forth. One of the difficulties of governing Russia in the post-Cold War era is that it is just as fragmented and just as subject to falling apart, perhaps, as the Soviet Union was. So Yeltsin has been, I think, tougher. Yeltsin in his time and Putin now have been tougher than they might otherwise be because they have this sense of vulnerability due to these ethnic groups. There was a striking report a few days ago in the New York Times about the lengths to which the Putin regime is currently going to homogenize history teaching in Russia. And there had been a lot of progress made in this area with there were a wide variety of history texts that were used. There were many new history texts. Many of them were high quality and so forth. And one of the great accomplishments of the post-Cold War era was that Russian children finally got to learn something of the truth of their history. And many of those history books were just recently banned. And part of the reason for that is that Putin has a close friend and crony who's in the publishing business. And his history books were not banned.
Don't I understand that the publishing company, I believe, is called Reformation, and it was the major publishing company under the Soviet regime. I read the article also, and that was one of my takeaways from it.
Should I assume, by the way, that the homogenization of texts now maligns Gorbachev?
I don't know quite how that plays out. I think that the difference most likely has more to do with the treatment of the Soviet history. Sort of the long stretch of Soviet history, rather than just at the end, in the Gorbachev era. But it's a one big sort of painful point in Soviet historiography has always been, well, what do you do with Stalin? I have an encyclopedia in my shelf in my office, the Bolshaya Sovetskaya Encyclopedia, which is a series of volumes that were printed from the early 1950s to the late 1950s. And they started with the beginning of the alphabet. So in the beginning of the alphabet, you get people like Lavrenty Beria, who was the head of the secret police under Stalin and was responsible for many thousands of victims being killed. And he gets a very respectful, long article with a picture and so forth. And because he was at B before he was unceremoniously thrown out in 1953. But then Stalin, because S comes further towards the end of the alphabet, gets a much smaller article because his volume wasn't published until after 1956 when Khrushchev had started the process of de-Stalinization. So what do you say about Stalin? Do you say anything about Stalin? Do you talk about his crimes and so forth as crimes against humanity, or do you put them in context? Or what do you do with this terrible historical figure?
How do they teach it in modern Russia?
Well, it was much more diverse. And my understanding is that it will be less diverse in the future, and that Stalin will be treated as an important historical figure. And not necessarily a personification of evil, as he had been thought to be at some point in the past.
But you can't go to hagiography because there's no credibility in hagiography with a guy like Stalin. But if you sort of dull the impact, there's probably a danger there that's even more extreme than hagiography, I would think.
Yes, I think there is. I mean, there's. Well, they're both bad, right?
But yes, but one is so obviously silly that no one would take it seriously, whereas the population may actually... and again, I'm someone who I love talking to Randy because I have no idea how... I want a world that is so happy and peaceful, et cetera, and where you don't have these issues and international divisions. And then you hear that Gorbachev is viewed very negatively, certainly within Russia, I guess, and viewed as sort of... weak and having made these great mistakes, as opposed to sort of being progressive and even heroic for Germans, etc. And then you hear that they're going to dull the impact of Stalin, and you think, how are we ever going to reach a world where there's common understanding of mistakes? I don't believe in a nationalism that says we haven't erred. And I don't believe it for this country, and I don't believe it for theirs, but it makes me concerned about future relations. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Very much so. And it also it plays a very big role in Russian relations, for example, with Ukraine. So how do you deal with the episode of collectivization of agriculture, right, which was one of Stalin's major policy initiatives which led to the death by starvation of millions of Ukrainians and Russians and many other ethnicities within the Soviet Union, but is particularly painful subject for Ukrainians, and is called by Ukrainians the Holodomor, right? The period of death by starvation, and viewed as an episode of genocide. So on the Russian side, if you are softening your interpretation of collectivization, you're attacking a fundamental aspect of Ukrainian national identity. And that sort of thing doesn't go unnoticed in neighboring countries that share so many bilingual members.
We only have about 90 seconds left, and I meant to do this last time Randy's here, and I always think this is a valuable question to ask. When we want to try to stay abreast of events happening in those parts of the world, what are good sources of news, even if they have to be translated, et cetera, that perhaps you could find online or maybe regular sources? Where do you turn to kind of stay abreast of events?
Well, I regularly read the New York Times. I received The Economist. The Financial Times of London is an excellent source. The American press tends to be captured by sort of mood swings and fads. And so if you really want to keep up with what's going on, you have to also look at the internet, read foreign newspapers and so forth. And that's, of course, difficult to do. But there now is a lot of English language source material that's coming right out of Russia. So if you want to keep abreast of those things, it's possible to do that.
And my son's going to grow up in a world with, we have a friend from Franconia, we have friends from different parts of Germany, but he doesn't think of, I mean, he lives in a world with Germany. What's your brief 30 seconds on the, essentially the reunification, that following the fall 25 years ago, the events that followed have been, you know, what's the brief take on history following that, the fall of the wall?
Well, the reunification of Germany was the sort of the dream of every German, but it was seemed impossible, and it turned out to be a lot more difficult than was expected. But in the end, a very worthwhile thing, which I think the Germans are glad was finally possible. But it's been painful. There have been painful economic dislocations as a result.
Thanks again for helping distill complex subjects for us, Randy Stone. It's always great to talk to you. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Professor at the University of Rochester and the director of the Skolnick Center, that's Randy Stone. Thanks to Chad Post as well from Open Letter Books and your calls and interests these 2 hours on this Tuesday. Beautiful Tuesday, November afternoon. Enjoy it. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.